Hello, kids! Unbat Segundo here, coming to you live from the Unmotel 6. I'm happy to report that I haven't had a drink in over 20 years, and that my radio career has taken off. Today, Doris and I celebrate our 25th anniversary. Despite my success, I'm all too happy to offer my services for free for this lively literary podcast. Stay tuned, loyal listeners, for China Mieville, one of the nicest guys our young roving correspondent has spoken with. Now, if you'll pardon me, I'm due at Loaves and Fishes for some charity work. Remember, kids, be good to your fellow humans, and always give them the benefit of the doubt.
Okay, so I am here with China Mieville, the author of Perdita Street Station, The Iron Council, and most recently, a YA book called Unlondon. China, how are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
It's a pleasure. First off, I wanted to actually ask you specifically about world building, which is a big factor in all of your books. How important is world building to you when you go ahead and write a book?
To me, as a writer, it has been important, particularly in the three Bass Lag books. It was a very big sort of factor, and I spent quite a lot of time kind of consolidating that world before sort of putting pen to paper or putting finger to keyboard. I suppose we have to change the phrase nowadays. But it's not. I mean, there are different ways of world building, and that when we say world building, we tend to think of that kind of D&D-esque kind of, which is not a diss, incidentally. It's just a description, sort of, you know, kind of consolidation of the geography and the history and the culture and so on before writing the story, and that's one way of doing it. But then there are others, which are less kind of rigid, less sort of to do with internal coherence in the same way. So. In terms of something like Unlondon or some of the short stories or even King Rat, and the book I'm working on at the moment as well, it's less to do with having a kind of coherent back narrative and more to do with having a kind of coherent sort of moral and emotional feeling. Mm-hmm. I know the whole question of world building is quite controversial at the moment because M. John Harrison just wrote his, you know, blistering attack on the whole idea, which I thought was, you know, characteristically for his stuff was, you know, a brilliant provocation, and, you know, full of a certain kind of angry integrity. I don't agree with him exactly, but I think it would be a fool who dismissed his criticisms out of hand.
Mm-hmm. Is an urban kind of center important for you when you create a world like Unlondon or New Kerbuzen or Maslag?
Mm. Well, it always has been. I mean, I grew up in cities. I love cities. I'm a city animal. And so cities tend to loom larger in my kind of imaginary than rurality. But not sort of completely. I mean, Iron Council had many, sort of quite deliberately, many kind of wilderness scenes and non-urban scenes. Yes, absolutely. I mean, the center of gravity in my head is definitely a kind of fantastic metropolis. And even when I'm not always writing about it, it's always there as a sort of absent presence somewhere.
Well, the one thing that's interesting about Unlondon to me is that it's essentially kind of the obverse of London, obviously. But not just that, you have this, the imagination per page ratio has really sort of jumped up in this book. We're seeing, like, almost on every single page in this book, you know, whether it's a chest of drawers bursting into the air, that's the building size. I'm wondering if this was kind of a conscious effort to sort of just up the imaginative fervor on your part, or?
Well, one of the reasons I got into this line of writing, one of the reasons I wrote Perdita Street Station, for example, was I just wanted a kind of license to put in anything, basically. You know, if I have what I think of as a cool idea, just put it in. And Perdita Street Station in particular was written with that kind of sort of exuberant ragbag mentality, you know. It's quite difficult to sustain. I mean, I think you then kind of pull back from that in some ways, and some of the later books have been more restrained in that way. Yeah. And there's no question that Unlondon was, in part, did feel like a kind of emancipation, that I could sort of indulge some of those sort of imaginative excesses, and it's partly because it's a book for younger readers, or with younger readers firmly in mind, although of course I hope adults also like it. when I was a kid and I was reading these books aged, you know, 10, 11, 12, whatever, basically, I think most writers would say this, I wrote Unlondon for my own 10-year-old self, and I loved books that had this kind of succession of the strange, and it's one of the reasons I liked Clive Barker's Aberrat book, mm-hmm. because there is a narrative and it's a good narrative, but it does seem to me, and this is not a criticism, that in his case the narrative is almost a kind of a way of threading between the fantastics, and I find that, I know some people might find that frustrating, but I find it really exciting. Mm-hmm.
I wanted to actually ask you about the possible sort of response to C.S. Lewis that I kind of detected. It's almost as if this book is something of a wry response. For example, you have the fisherman who is trying to negotiate with the smog, and he basically gets swallowed up. And I kept thinking when I read that, not only did I think that was just a really funny moment, but also it seemed to me as if this was kind of like the anti-Narnia to some degree. I was wondering if this was in your mind, or if Christianity was something you were kind of exploring, because there is a bit of a history of YA literature with Christian themes in it.
Truthfully, in the case of Lewis, he didn't loom that large I wasn't consciously arguing with him. I was arguing affectionately and respectfully, I hope, with slightly different traditions. I mean, in part, the Narnia books, although I did read them and they were a relatively sort of large thing for me, they weren't one of my kind of mental classics. Yeah. I mean, for me, it was Joan Aiken, Lewis Carroll, Michael de Larrabeatty, Beatrix Potter, Norton Juster, you know, these were the, you know, and Lewis, I mean, as a child, I thought they were okay, but they didn't sort of set my world on fire by any means. They don't loom that large in my mental horizons. Subsequently, rereading them, I've grown to have quite a strong sort of antipathetic reaction to them in various ways. And I think that, in one sense, it would be almost redundant to have a kind of argument with Lewis, at least at a conscious level these days, because of Philip Pullman. I mean, Philip Pullman's whole project seems to me to be a devastating and extremely erudite and thoughtful argument with Lewis's particular brand of Christianity. Because I think it's quite important to say that if you're arguing with Lewis, you're not arguing with Christianity, you're arguing with his particular vision of essentially kind of English private school Anglicanism, you know. So at a conscious level, no, I wasn't specifically arguing with Lewis. But I also think I don't think authorial intention is by any means the most interesting thing about a book. And, you know, what I think I was doing and intended to do may not be, you know, the most interesting or accurate thing that's going on there. So all I can tell you is what was in my head at the time.
Gotcha. Well, I'm wondering if ideology played a sort of important aspect in this book. For example, you have the bus driver who lets people on, and he doesn't necessarily check their fares. And I kept thinking, oh, is this kind of sort of quasi-Marxist, perhaps?
Well, I mean, the thing is, because I'm known to have a kind of political politics are important to me, and I do come from the left, and I'm a socialist, and so on. So, people, I think, often see these things in the book, and I'm not saying that that's inaccurate. It is perfectly accurate, but it's also for me in narrative terms, it's never sort of dependent on that. You know, the aim is, it's quite difficult to express. It's not about trying to push it to the background, because political ideas are foundational to me. They absolutely are. Mm-hmm. And the stuff you noticed, and there's some stuff about, you know, terror and government mendacity and, you know, pollution and
the smog.
The war.
You allude specifically to the 1952 London.
Exactly. You know, so all this stuff is there. But the way I think of it is not to do with... I don't think of it as background. I think of it as sort of foundation. Mm-hmm. And then you sort of build this kind of house of narrative, whatever, on that. And if you're interested in the whole structure, you can see the foundation and you can sort of debate or argue or agree or disagree. If you're not interested, it doesn't mean you can't still enjoy the house, you know. So yes, those things are there, but they're not sort of to agree or to see that is not sort of necessary to read the story, I think. In the case of what you're talking about, actually, there was also a much more sort of visceral thing for me, which is that in London for many years we had these lovely old buses called Route Masters, which had a conductor and had a driver. Mm-hmm. And then over the last sort of 20 years, they've phased out the conductors and now we only have a driver. Yeah. And they did it for cost cutting, and it has led to, you know, a slowing down because the driver has to take all the tickets. So each time you stop at a stop, it takes longer and so on and so forth. And part of that discussion in that book was just me simply waxing frustrated about this penny pinching, which had a bad impact on London transport, you know.
I'm wondering, since politics is such a foundation for you, do you find yourself trying to quell a sort of didactic impulse to put into your writing? Because, I mean, your books definitely are grounded upon, yeah, you know, political and socioeconomic themes, and I'm wondering if this sometimes, as you write or create an outline, whether this gets in the way of constructing a narrative.
Well, I mean, I know that there may very well be. In fact, I know that there are some readers who think not only that I, you know, that does happen, but that I fail to do so. I mean, there are readers who say, you know, China Mobile is too didactic, I don't need to read a socialist creed or whatever. I'm always slightly surprised. I can see that maybe with Iron Council, although Iron Council, to me, was, you know, the best and most important of the adult books I've written. But I know that a lot of readers, you know, had some arguments with it, to say the least, and partly because the politics were more overt in that book. But for the most part, for the rest, I have to say, at a conscious level, I really don't feel a strong need to a kind of tension between the sort of political argument and the sort of narrative and the fantastic, because, and I've said this in another interview, you know, I'm not like a leftist trying to smuggle my message in by nefarious means. Mm-hmm. You know, what I am is a fantasy and science fiction geek. You know, this is the stuff I love. This is the stuff I wanted to work in. This is what I grew up reading. I'm also a socialist, you know, and inevitably those ideas are going to be there in the stuff I write. But when I write, if I want to make a political point, you know, if I want to make a political argument, I'll write a political pamphlet. Mm-hmm. I know I'll do that because I've done it. You know, this is, you know, whereas when I write the narrative, what I want to do is I want to invent monsters. I want to invent a fantastic landscape. I want to tell a story that keeps people turning the pages. So I realize that some readers may not always agree, but I don't feel remotely didactic when I'm writing the fiction, you know, and it doesn't feel like a tension in me at all. It's not that big a deal for me. The whole kind of balancing politics and fiction, which people often ask me about, has never felt like an issue for me, you know. And I think maybe, you know, there are plenty of writers of fantastic fiction who have very strong political views, and I think political views that are central to their fiction. I think, you know, for example, I would suggest that Gene Wolfe's fiction, you know, is absolutely penetrated with his particular kind of Catholic republicanism. And that, you know, although I obviously disagree with him politically, I think it makes for absolutely profound and amazing fiction. I think he's, you know, outstanding. Mm-hmm. You know, Mark Halperin, you know, I think you can see his politics in Winter's Tale. And again, you know, I disagree with his politics. It doesn't mean that I necessarily don't like the fiction, you know. And I think maybe because I'm on the left, people sort of often think it must be a big deal, something I have to juggle. And all I can say is, from where I'm sitting, it doesn't feel like a contradiction or a difficulty at all.
But there's also the potential misperception. Like, for example, we have the smog in On London. Mm. I mean, that is a very clear kind of, you can see an environmentalist, sure, kind of message in there, and that might actually take some people away who are, yeah, more inclined to see political, yeah, messages, and they might just say, oh, well, this is more of a treatise to sort of, yeah, pollute young wine, yeah, so to speak, with this environmentalism,
well,
stuff.
Let me give you an example. That's a very good example. I mean, the smog in this book is, you know, one of the essentially the big baddie is a kind of malevolent, sentient kind of coagulum of pollution called the smog. And you're absolutely right. That does, of course, lead to a certain kind of ecological concerns. Issues of ecology are raised in the book and so on. But the etiology of the smog as the kind of character in the book, you know, with my hand on my heart, went as follows. Me thinking of monsters, because I wanted to write a book for younger readers full of monsters set in a weird version of London. Thinking of cool monsters, and then thinking out of, you know, various different ideas, suddenly saying, hey, intelligent poisoned smog, cool. What a cool monster.
Yeah.
And then thinking, well, that raises certain interesting ideas about pollution and so on. And so it started, and this is what happens with most of my writing, that rather than sort of trying to work out how to smuggle in the message, I think of a monster or a scene or whatever out of the kind of pleasure and joy of that kind of grotesque. And then in some cases, that opens the door to certain kind of political ideas, which, sure, out of a certain kind of interest, I'll sort of sprinkle in there, but they don't come first. They're not, and obviously I'm delighted if readers are interested in that stuff and pick up on them and want to talk about them, but that's not what it is for, in inverted commas.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, though, if you've created the monster and you've sort of vetoed it because it's like, oh, well, this is really sort of flagrant, the sort of gray areas are really non-existent here, and this is very much a clear-cut sort of political monster. Mm. Have you had that sort of situation come up in devising these things? I mean, you're obviously a very imaginative guy, if anyone reading your work can see that, so I'm sure there has to be some kind of veto process.
That's a very interesting question, actually. I will say there have been occasions where I've thought of a monster or a setting or whatever, and in retrospect, I've decided not to use it because it seems to me that it reads too narrowly allegorical.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it reads too narrowly allegorical, as if I'm trying to make a polemical point. And occasionally, the other way around, I'll nix it because it seems to imply a political point that I don't agree with. But even if it's one that I do agree with, if it seems too narrow and sort of trite, then I'll tend not to use the creature or the setting because I don't want it to collapse into this kind of didactic allegory. But the interesting thing, I think, is that for me is that that tends to be a situation where I realize there's a kind of allegorical reductionism after I've thought of the monster.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that I sort of think, I really want to make a point about such and such. Then I think of a monster, then I think, no, that's too obvious. It's that I'll think, this is a nice idea for a creature. And then I'll think, yeah, but whether I intend it or not, that's going to read a certain way. I mean, in The Scar, for example, there's a set of monsters called the Anopheli, who are kind of human mosquito women, and the reason that it is the women who suck blood is because it is female mosquitoes that suck blood. And I was really, and I hate mosquitoes, and thought it was a really good monster, so I sort of wrote about it, and then I realised that the idea of the kind of the blood sucking female is a fairly trite image from a certain kind of sexist or misogynist fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
And so I sort of had to think about how to make it clear that I'm not trying to make that kind of point. And so I have one of the characters in the novel basically make that analogy and another one say, don't be an idiot. Mm-hmm. And that was because I just liked those monsters too much. I didn't want to let them go. But certainly I am aware of the dangers of a kind of too narrow reading of some of these figures, yeah.
So for you, it's actually very difficult to kind of play around with a monster or feature a monster that is differing from your ideological viewpoint. You find this, I mean, maybe there's something to be said for exploring an idea or that is outside of your, usual kind of intellectual purview.
Well, I must not be sort of expressing myself because I don't feel that at all. What happens is, when I think about monsters, I don't think, that it does not start, well, what is this monster going to read? What is the politics of this? I think, what a cool monster. How about I took a guy and I gave him lobster claws and I sit him on a slug's, eye stalk. That's how I create monsters. And then sometimes, and not always by any means, but sometimes I'll have some sort of playful ideas about, maybe I can, maybe think about sort of certain political issues or whatever that this might lead to, putting a little bit of seasoning in. And very occasionally, I'll feel uneasy about some of the kind of aesthetic ramifications of a figure that comes up. I certainly don't feel, I mean, for a start, I don't think there is such a thing as a right-wing or a left-wing monster. I mean, I think that, there are interpretations and there are...
Well, we have a right-wing monster here, so...
I guess what I'm kind of groping to try to say is I do understand that this is of a lot of interest to people and that people, ask me about it a lot and wonder about that kind of process of negotiation. All I can say and stress is that, as a writer, it does. It never feels like an issue to me. I mean, there are these occasions when I'll sort of think, well, that might have some ramifications I'm a bit unhappy with, and I might. But I think many writers do that. People who aren't necessarily, you know, particularly on, you know, socialist or on the left or even on the right, they might suddenly realise that, even though they hadn't meant it, you know, there are certain slightly socially uncomfortable ramifications from a particular figure they create, so they'll change it or tone it down. That's a kind of politeness, you know. So that's all I'm saying, in a way. It certainly doesn't feel like a big complicated issue to me at all.
I wanted to actually go away from the subconscious sort of process and deal with the conscious process, specifically of On London. You're writing for younger readers. You're a guy who specializes in arcane language in a lot of your previous books. Was this a struggle for you as you were drafting this book? Because, I mean, now all of a sudden, like, you know, using a word like palimpsest is kind of out of the question.
Well, I mean, for a start, I don't think it is out of the question. I think, but you're absolutely right that there was a kind of a negotiation. What I did, I set myself an experiment. I said, you know, I really want to write a YA book because I want to write the kind of book I read when I was 10, 11. I've wanted to do so for years, but I don't know if I can do it because I've never written for this age range before. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to set myself 2 weeks and I'm going to write for 2 weeks and then I'm going to take a look and I'm going to see what I've done and I'm going to see if I feel I can do it. And I didn't know whether it would be, as you say, very difficult at the level of language to kind of restrain it. And it wasn't that, I didn't find it that hard. I mean, essentially there was, all I did was I toned down some of my adult work has very baroque language and, you know, in some cases sort of quite arcane sentence construction and so on, and I kind of toned down some of that. And I didn't want to dumb it down because I think, you know, you underestimate the capabilities of younger readers at your peril, but I wanted to go a little bit more sort of overt clarity, let's say. And I didn't nix the idea of using any, you know, complicated words or neologisms or relatively arcane words, but I maybe had a few fewer. You know, I sort of didn't, you know, put them in every few lines. I might put one or two in every page or so. You know, I don't mind sending readers to the dictionary, but maybe not quite, you know.
Well, you couldn't resist arachnofenestrat.
Well, arachnofenestronaut was my big, yeah, that was my money shot neologism in the book. So that was, you know, I was definitely aware of it as a strategy, but it didn't feel particularly hard. I was pleasantly surprised with how smoothly the writing came.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, the disappearance of Xena. You know, she and Deba both appear in the first part. Xena, thank you. Sorry about that. She appears in the first part of the book, and then she disappears. And then I'm wondering if what provoked her disappearance. Did you sort of want to kind of throw people off on who the protagonist was?
I need to sort of preface this by saying that we're into spoiler territory.
Oh, okay.
I don't mind talking about it, but I think we should flag up that anyone who, you know, who really is very keen to avoid spoilers should probably stop listening for 5 minutes or so. Okay. So with that warning in place, and those people still listening, Xena, you know, appears and then sort of disappears, as you say. And basically the reason is that, you know, much of the book, and as I say, here we're into spoilers, is I've always, as a very young reader, I had a great disinclination to follow through fiction that had a very strong narrative to do with fate and destiny and a particular chosen one, you know, and I found it alienating as a reader. I found it alienating for two main reasons. Firstly, because if it was sort of prophesied that a particular character was going to do a particular thing, it lost my interest as a reader in, you know, reading to the end. Why would, you know, because I kind of know what's supposed to happen, you know. And I remember from a very young age, like 10 years old, reading books with this as an idea in it and feeling immensely let down when it comes to that, because I felt like I found it much harder to sustain interest. And the other and the secondary thing was that I always, and again, since a very young age, I always felt very sorry for the sidekicks. I felt like they never got their due, and I felt like, you know, that these narratives kind of focused on the, you know, on the chosen one in inverted commas, and that, you know, Velma did not get her due compared to Daphne, you know, and And I never particularly felt like a chosen one. I was always kind of more of a sidekick, you know. Yeah. So I sort of felt like what I wanted to do was kind of affectionately tweak that idea in this book and sort of have, you know, the character who is, you know, written as, you know, who's prophesied to be the chosen one, and, you know, kind of doesn't really work out that way. And the most dramatic, you know, you're right, one of the most kind of clear and dramatic ways of doing that is essentially to sort of remove her from the narrative. So I appreciate that it's rather a kind of a sudden sort of narrative shift, but it was absolutely deliberate for that reason. You know, whether or not it works is, you know, up to the readers, but it was a clear, you know, specific decision for that reason, to foreground someone who had been more in the background and vice versa.
How much are surprises important to you when constructing a narrative? It seems to me that they clearly are, but maybe you can talk about this a little bit more.
I like twists and turns and all that sort of stuff, but my feeling is not that, you know, they themselves are crucial. I mean, I've read, you know, plenty of books, you know, knowing the twist or whatever and still enjoyed them. My line is just that fair warning has to be given, mm-hmm. you know. So if people don't mind knowing about, you know, twists or turns or whatever, then fine. You know, what concerns me is when reviews and discussions give things away, give, you know, particularly twists, but from my perspective, even just plot details, when they yeah. give things away without warning the reader that they are going to do so. Yeah. If you give a warning, you're absolutely covered. Carte blanche, say what you want. And I understand the discussion of certain books requires spoilers. So to have an interesting discussion about it, you have to say off the bat, we're going to talk about this. And that I have no problem with. It's the lack of warning that troubles me. And I feel like if there's a film or a book or whatever that I know for a fact I want to read, I'll avoid all reviews, mm-hmm. because people, I think, are lamentably sort of uncareful about explaining if they're going to give things away. And there's this weird notion, I see it in a lot of film reviews, that, for example, a film review will say, this is, you know, a really excellent thriller with a superb twist. And they think that because they haven't said what the twist is, they haven't given anything away. That is... Can I swear? That
yeah,
is,
absolutely. That it's is, podcasting.
So. Fucking ridiculous. Yeah. You know, if you go into a film knowing that there's a twist, you're not watching it. The twist is not going to get you in the same way as if you didn't know there was a twist. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the simple fact that you flag these things up can spoil them. And I repeat, I have no problem with spoiling them if you warn people that you're going to do so. So I'm quite happy to talk about, you know, these themes, sure. as long as the listeners know that I'm going to do so. That's my
rule was, since it happens at, you know, within the first 100 pages, yeah. I felt it was safe territory.
But you're right. Yeah, it's certainly I don't want to give people the impression that it's like a huge, you know, that if you know that then you've ruined the whole book. And it's not the case at all. And plenty of the reviews have given it away, as I say. I mean, there is a sense in which you try and sort of shut the stable door after the horse has bolted, because as soon as something is reviewed, mm-hmm. it's basically out there, you know, and you're not really in control of it. So my position is simply that, you know, I'm happy to discuss anything. I will just make a little flag that there's going to be a spoiler warning in some cases.
Yeah. Well, this actually makes me want to ask you, for you, are your books more about the journey rather than the destination? Because your destinations, as in the case of The End of Perdido Street Station, are often... how shall we say this without spoiling it?
It's not a question I'm particularly aware of. You know, I don't. You know, you ask the question, and I kind of immediately have to kind of translate in my own head, because I don't think to myself in terms of destinations versus journeys as a writer. Yeah, you know, in terms. I mean, I am. Definitely more interested. I mean, I'm very, very interested in the texture of the worlds that I'm writing about, and so on. And I have no fear of, you know, I know, you know, some people would say, you know, excessive lack of fear of sort of byways and, you know, discussions yeah. of side scenes and so on, because I enjoy that texture. So maybe you could say that's about journey rather than destination. But that isn't to say that I don't think very carefully about the culmination of everything I write. And I read reviews, like reviews of, particularly of The Scar, actually, which sort of said, you know, well, you know, I enjoyed the book, but, you know, Mieville clearly didn't know how to end it. And I also think, well, okay, it didn't work for you, and fair enough. But the idea that that was just a mistake, that that was just because I didn't know what to say, so it just is, you know, that that ending was extremely carefully thought out, and to me has absolute closure, although possibly not closure on the plane that some readers wanted. The Iron Council, the ending of Iron Council, to me, is probably the most, you know, important 30 pages I'll ever write, you know, and the whole book was about that ending, and I was vividly conscious of that all the way through. I never write a book without knowing what the ending will be. So I very much enjoy the journey, that is absolutely true, but the ending isn't just a kind of, you know, a kind of a full stop. Oh, yeah.
So if you write a book knowing full well where the ending is going to be, then I guess the question is what do you do to kind of create this sort of fertile ground where you can sort of, you know, launch imagination and launch these chest drawer buildings and the like? I mean, do you kind of keep things, how loose do you keep things?
I plot, you mean in terms of plot and
so on? Yeah,
well,
yeah.
I plot very, very, very carefully. I mean, all my books have a very sort of rigid, some might say anal, sort of a outline before I start. And then halfway through, and as I go along, there are deviations because you realize that something's not working, so you change something else, blah, blah, blah. So it's not cast in stone, but if I start to realize there are changes halfway through, I'll stop and I'll kind of rejig the outline and sort of cascade the changes all the way down so that I know what the tweaked ending will be. So I have fairly clear arcs in mind with everything I write, short stories, novels, everything. In terms of, like, you know, kind of enjoying the byways and the texture along the way, it's just it's never an issue because I don't say this in a kind of self-aggrandizing way. It's not, you know, different people think about the world in different ways. But in terms of, for me, it just happens that, you know, the way I think about things, the way I see the world, is always to do with kind of concatenating stuff together and making grotesques and making the fantastic. So, you know, so it's not a question of saying, how do you kind of have the, you know, if you have this rigid structure, how do you think up sort of, you know, cool ideas or fantasy ideas to kind of go along the way? It's the opposite. It's how do you decide which of the many ideas you're coming up with are simply too many and you have to leave them out? Mm-hmm. And I think that, I mean, you have to forgive me, this is an example I've used before, but I think it's quite a good example in terms of that sort of fantasticating eye, and the kind of grotesquing eye, is, you know, the world is split into two different kinds of people. When I moved into my flat, we were having all of our kind of kitchen goods delivered, and my then girlfriend took a phone call and got off the phone and said to me, we need to stay in because the fridge men are coming. Mm-hmm. Now, the world is divided into those people who hear that sentence and say, okay, I need to be in because I'm going to get a kitchen delivery, and those who hear the word fridge men and immediately conceive of a kind of cyborg creature with a big open door in its chest and stomping arms and legs and a kind of freezing demeanor, a kind of, you know, fridge man hybrid. I'm of that latter school. So you simply hear these words and you immediately sort of fantasticate and grotesque, and that's the way I think about things. So it's never, for me, it's never a difficulty to kind of come up with stuff to put in the books. It's more a question of restraining myself and not putting in too much.
Well, what steps, I mean, this is a comparatively slimmer book because it's YA compared to your other ones.
It's quite a long one.
It is a long one by comparison, but I guess what you had to do with this is an even more kind of restraining of your sort of imaginative tendencies. This might be why I kind of recognize the imagination per page ratio is a lot greater in this one than in the other ones, which were more, you know, which had dialogue, because it was every page. It was like, whoa, okay, mm-hmm. There's a new monster here.
Well, you're absolutely right that there was, I felt more kind of emancipated to indulge that, and I do recognize that there's a danger of excess, and it may well, and in fact, I, in the second draft, and with the help of an editor and stuff, I cut out various other things that were in there, and I realized that, you know, for some readers, there will still be too much stuff happening, fair enough, but I did feel, because I was remembering how I liked to read as a child, and I was thinking about something like The Phantom Tollbooth, which is, you know, a kind of page by page introduction of a cool, strange thing, a cool, strange idea. So it was partly a kind of unrestrainedness, and it was also partly a slightly different kind of fantastic, although related to what I do with my adult books, but more to do with, there was more of a kind of indulgence of something like wordplay than there is in my adult books. And so, for example, several of the characters in Un-London are basically the literalizations of bad puns, mm-hmm. With a kind of, a sort of affection for sort of silly wordplay, bad wordplay. Now, there are writers that can do that in an adult book. And I think, for example, one of Steph Swainston's books has a creature in it which is called a fiber-toothed tiger, and this is, and I loved that book. I thought it was great. And I thought it was a very funny, very cool moment. But I can't do that. I can't do that kind of sort of verbally playful fantasy in my adult settings. The fantasy tends to be more to do with a kind of self-referential coherence. So in this book, I kind of was able to indulge myself in creating kind of monsters called Black Windows, and the other example is the Binger, which, in British English we call trash cans bins, mm-hmm. and they're martial artists, so they're ninja, so they're Binger, So you take this silly pun and then you just literalize it and run with it and so on. And that was a great pleasure because I couldn't do that in my adult writing. And so So I really, really enjoyed doing that.
So for you, the imaginative impulse largely comes from this concern for language, then, you would say, for the most of the time.
I honestly think for me as a writer and as a sort of perceiver of the world, the fantasy impulse is inextricable from seeing the world. Everything I see, I sort of, think of in fantasy terms, and it's particularly monsters, but the grotesque in general. And as I say, I think this is to some extent sort of just a kind of congenital condition. One either does or doesn't think like this. And to me, I always translate into the fantastic more or less everything I read or see or do. So yes, it can be to do with wordplay. It can also be to do with random juxtaposition, seeing two things. It's the surrealist thing of seeing, an umbrella and a sewing machine on a dissecting table, seeing two random things on a table and, merging them in your mind, or, kind of glimpsing something as you're walking down the street. It's kind of everything.
You have to get going. I'm very sorry. I have plenty of questions for you, but Chana, it was a great pleasure chatting with you. Hopefully we can chat again.
Well, thank you for having me.
Great, thanks.
I saw a werewolf with a Chinese menu in his hand, walking through the streets of Soho in the rain.